When a few American banks get sick, others around the globe worry about catching the sniffles. Investors and depositors sense contagion.
So people realize, oh, I thought the banks would never fail again, but now they actually are. So let me see what's happening at my bank.
Also today, hunger is on the rise in many countries. The head of the World Food Program tells us what's at stake.
You begin to see why there is truly chaos, hell on earth coming to a theater near you soon if we don't get on top of this stuff.
And in Nigeria, surf's up. For surfing newbies, catching a wave is nothing short of a miracle.
First time I saw them surfing, I thought they were like Jesus Christ walking on top of water. So I was like, wow, Jesus, I have to learn this sport.
I'm Marco Werman, plus getting solutions jump-started after a sobering climate report. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. There is high anxiety in the global economy right now. Today and tomorrow, the Federal Reserve is meeting to tackle the confluence of inflation colliding with chaos in the banking world. The Fed is deciding what to do about interest rates, keep raising them to try and tame inflation, or pull back to ease pressure on the banks. Global investors are anxiously watching. The Fed's decision will also have big impacts on Main Street, and not just Main Street USA. The World's Jason Margolis gets us going today.
One bank fails, not a big deal, unless you have a lot of money in that bank. For the rest of us, the big risk is contagion.
Contagion is really obviously a taken from a medical term.
Galena Hale is an economist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and former advisor with the Federal Reserve. She explains that just as infectious disease spreads, the same thing can happen in the banking world.
So contagion is essentially when a problem in one financial institution is creating problems for others, otherwise healthy financial institutions.
In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, it went too big on bond investments. Depositors got spooked, wanted their money out right away, and a good old-fashioned bank run ensued. Then fear started to spread.
What we see internationally is mostly this wake-up call contagion, right? So people realize, oh, I thought the banks would never fail again, but now they actually are. So let me see what's happening at my bank.
Banks are different than other businesses. Think of it this way. When a pizza place in your neighborhood fails, it's an opportunity for the other guys to step in and sell more pizza. That's not exactly how it works for banks. When one bank goes bust, it can ripple through the industry. The problems at Credit Suisse were different than at Silicon Valley Bank. And to be clear, Credit Suisse was not a healthy bank. Its balance sheet also looked shaky, filled with bad investments. Still, when a few U.S. banks went down, investors in Credit Suisse got panicky. Then that set off worries about a possible chain reaction. That banks would start falling like dominoes. That's when the cavalry showed up.
We are monitoring current market tensions closely and stand ready to respond as necessary.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen speaking to Congress last week, and Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank. They assured us 2023 is not 2008, and that was really bad.
On September 16th, 2008, all around the world, money stopped.
My God, we may be presiding over the Second Great Depression.
A trailer for PBS's Frontline there. After that disaster, tighter global regulations were put in place, as well as country-specific laws. Banks are now required to keep more capital on hand in case there's a bank run. And regulators put banks through tougher stress tests to make sure they can handle a worst-case scenario. That gives global investors like Bob Elliott confidence.
A lot of the framework that applies in the U.S. is also applied in Europe and in Asia.
Elliott is the chief information officer of the investment firm Unlimited. He says when troubles start in the banking sector, investors are looking for a quick regulatory response.
And the faster and more agile that they do, the less impact it will have on investors and the macroeconomy. And so far, regulatory authorities, both in the U.S. and Europe and Switzerland, have done a pretty good job at being responsive.
So just a bump in the road this time? A few bad banks gone bust? Or perhaps deeper failures in regulatory supervision? I asked economists Galena Hale and Kenneth Rogoff at Harvard if we're out of the woods yet.
At the moment, I'm not too worried. I think this problem might be contained, but We have said these words in 2007 when we thought all the problem is contained. But I think now we know a lot more.
Well, I think it's too early to say. I mean, we have to understand that financial crises unfold in waves. There are more waves to come. I mean, getting to the level of 2008, which was the worst thing since the Great Depression, we got a ways to go there to get to that.
Rogoff says central bankers are keenly aware of the risks this time, but rescue operations underway in the U.S. and Europe are also coming with high costs for the rest of us, as governments once again ride to the rescue with big bailouts.
Oh, it was a bailout. They'll call it a backstop. This is semantics. It was a bailout, and they are using taxpayer money. I believe they did the right thing, let me be clear, but there was no way to do it without at least putting taxpayer money at considerable risk.
Helping out failing banks creates two additional problems. First, it incentivizes banks to take more risks.
Of course it does. Pretty much everything's been guaranteed. And that's not a good position to be in, because then, banks just take too many risks. Now, the government's saying, don't worry about that. We're going to regulate everything.
And that's problem number two. Too much regulation can slow the entire economy down, making it harder for homebuyers or businesses to get a loan. Which brings us back to the Fed's meeting this week. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has the unenviable task of trying to simultaneously tackle inflation, the risk of a global recession, and a banking sector in trouble. For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
It was news that shocked people in the UK and London especially. In 2019, 33-year-old Sarah Everard was walking home from a friend's house in South London when she was kidnapped by a city police officer who then raped and murdered her. An inquiry into the Metropolitan Police was launched. It was run by Baroness Louise Casey. Today, after a year of investigation, the conclusions of Baroness Casey's review are public. They detail a huge police force that is riven with racism, misogyny, and misconduct. It's not entirely clear where the quest for accountability heads next. The public is still digesting the findings. Andy George is the president of the National Black Police Association in the UK, and he joins us from London. First of all, Andy, what is in this report?
This report, it is a scathing report. It has taken well over a year for Baroness Casey to conduct. She's done interviews with victims, with whistleblowers. She's done a deep dive into the misconduct system internally with our vetting system, with discrimination claims through grievance processes. And she has found that the Met tolerates a culture of racism, misogyny, and homophobia. So a damning report, but unfortunately, it's only the latest in a long line of reports which have laid similar findings at the doorstep of the Metropolitan Police Service.
Fair to say that it is the highest profile report so far, though.
It's one of the highest. I mean, like, we have had every 20 years, we have a kind of almost a report like this. We had the Scarman report in 1981. We had the McPherson report in 1999, and now Baroness Casey's review. So even within the last couple of years, this is the highest profile in probably 25 years.
Right. Andy, how did you feel reading the report?
I think, if I'm honest, the report, it left you feeling sick to your stomach. You know, it's laid in black and white some of the experiences which our members have, which we've been challenging and pushing for changes on from our existence 25 years ago. So it did kind of almost vindicate what we'd been saying for quite a while, but really disappointing that it took an external review to look at the data, to look at the trends, which Metropolitan Police Service leadership team could have done themselves. You know, and I think what they need to do is make sure that this is the line in the sand. This is the moment when things change for good.
As for the conclusions about racism within the Met, have you been hearing from black officers today, and what are they saying?
Yes, definitely liaison with a lot of our membership. And what they're saying is, you know, they are tired, they're weary, they're traumatized with reports like this, with the failure of their leadership team to actually fully acknowledge the issues that they're putting forward. They feel like this is another watershed moment. They're fearful that we will hear the usual apologies for letting it get as bad as what it is, promises that we're going to change things. And a lack of activity, a lack of change. Their hopes have been raised and just broken up too many occasions.
So are we talking about racism between white cops and those of color, as well as racist attitudes of cops on the beat toward the people they're supposed to be protecting?
Definitely. It is both internal and external. So, I mean, like in London alone, you're about four times more likely to be stopped and searched or stopped and frisked. As you would say in America, you are twice as likely to have force used on you, twice as likely to die in police custody. There was a stat recently, you're seven times more likely to die after police restraint. Internally, Baroness Casey found you were 81% more likely to face misconduct action in the Metropolitan Police Service if you were black. So it's racism that's internal, it's racism that's external, and it just appears that the Metropolitan Police Service views black people in a racist manner.
The Metropolitan Police issued a statement in response to Baroness Casey's review. What was the gist of it, and what was your reaction?
Again, it was similar to what we've heard before, you know, the usual kind of apologies that things had got to where they were. So for us, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner should have acknowledged the fact that there is institutional racism within the Met. The fact that he's accepting some of the findings and not all kind of probably leads us to where how sincere he is about actually bringing about change.
While Baroness Casey was in the midst of this investigation, another Met officer, David Carrick, was convicted of a series of rapes and sexual offences. I'm just wondering, what's at the root of these cases of extreme misogyny, and does it play out in more subtle ways that we don't hear about?
Well, part of what Baroness Casey found was those two particular officers, Wayne Cousins, who kidnapped and murdered and raped Sarah Everard, and David Carrick, who I think had something like 47 rape and sexual offence cases against them. Both of them were in the Diplomatic Protection Group, so they were in a firearms team whose duty it is to protect the MPs and protect Parliament and other dignitaries. So there's a lot of downtime in that unit. There's definitely a macho attitude. And I think Wayne Cousins within his unit was known as the rapist. And the other guy was, I'll not say the word. So people knew that these people should be looked at. Probably shouldn't be in policing, but nobody had the courage to call them out and to push them forward. Wayne Cousins actually exposed himself a couple of weeks at a drive-through, a McDonald's drive-through restaurant, to the drive-through. He also had another report a few months before that, but it wasn't picked up on that he was a serving police officer. And the disappointing bit is he used his warrant card to handcuff and to get Sarah Everard alone, where she actually trusted him.
What, in your mind, needs to be done within the Met police force to turn things around so that in another 20 years, there's a report that shows some improvement?
Well, what we've called for is fundamental reform. It needs to be broken down. There's 32,000 officers within it. It's just too big for any one person to turn around. And we also need independent scrutiny and oversight of the internal misconduct and grievance system, because policing at the minute, those people that raise issues, whistleblow, they're often seen as the problem, and that needs to change.
Andy George is the president of the National Black Police Association in the UK, sharing his reactions to a just-released report looking at the problems within London's Metropolitan Police Force. He joined us from London. Andy, thank you very much indeed for your time.
No worries at all. Thank you.
Lagos, Nigeria, is a city of more than 15 million people. It's also a place where you can learn to surf in the warm water off the West African coast. Coming up, we hit the waves. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Global cocaine production is up 35% over the past couple of years, according to the UN. More illegal product also means more confiscations, and disposing of cocaine can be challenging. But as the world's TB Saizea reports, one country in South America has a novel solution.
Authorities in Ecuador are ramping up their fight against drug gangs. In 2022, police there say they confiscated more than 200 tons of drugs. That's almost double the amount of the previous year. Ecuador's President Guillermo Lasso calls this a success. But here's the problem. The government doesn't have the capacity to get rid of such huge amounts of illicit drugs, and putting them into storage for any length of time can be risky, according to Martin Reiter Hopper. He's with the United Nations Office on Illicit Drugs.
There are a lot of people in the country who are interested in it and might want to get it back, right? So it is really necessary to dispose such large volumes in a short period of time and do that safely.
The most common method for drug disposal around the world is incineration. To do it safely, authorities need a very specific type of facility,
which has scrubbers to clean the waste gas, because there could be the formation of highly toxic substances in the waste gas, which you don't want to have in the environment. You cannot just like burn it in any kind of facility available.
Because Ecuador doesn't have enough of these industrial incinerators, authorities are trying a different option. They're turning cocaine into cement that can be used for construction projects. Edmundo Mera is the undersecretary for drug control at Ecuador's Interior Ministry. He explains this process in a video posted on Twitter.
Lo primero que se hace es se somete a un proceso de pulverización.
First, they pulverize bricks of confiscated cocaine with heavy machinery. Next, this powder is mixed with cement, salt, and other chemicals to form a slurry. That slurry is molded into concrete slabs and left to dry for a few hours before they completely harden. This method is called encapsulation. Reiter Hober says it's impossible to extract any cocaine from the final product.
It's completely sealed. Nothing can leak into the environment. It's not accessible anymore. It's hard, solid cement.
Ecuador has destroyed around 80% of the drugs confiscated last year using this technique. United Nations officials hope others follow this example. They're training law enforcement agencies in Latin America, Asia, and Europe on drug disposal methods, including encapsulation. Reitel Huber says this process is getting a lot of attention because there is an urgent need for it right now.
We're advising on all these methods, how they work, what needs to be done to do it safely for the operators and for the environment.
He says encapsulation is not just safer, it's more efficient than incineration because it takes a fraction of the time. Those concrete blocks made with confiscated cocaine are being used as part of a new waste disposal facility in Ecuador. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Nigeria has some 500 miles of turquoise coastline along the Atlantic Ocean. Today, more and more people there are trying to surf the waves. From Nigeria's biggest city, Lagos, which faces that water, the world's Halima Gikandi has more.
To get to the Tarkwa Bay beach in Lagos, you have to take a small motorboat. This is still the Atlantic Ocean, but the water is much warmer than the east coast of the U.S. Tourists and Nigerians alike are hanging out, enjoying their weekend. Tarkwa Bay is where 32-year-old surfing instructor Godpower Tamaruko Pekipuma grew up. And this is where he saw someone surfing for the very first time.
When I was like 8 years old, I saw two guys surfing here in Tarkwa. The first time I saw them surfing, I thought they were like Jesus Christ walking on top of water. So I was like, wow, Jesus, I have to learn this sport.
From that point on, Pekipuma says he wanted to be out on the water too, but he tells me his parents wouldn't allow it.
But my parents didn't allow me to come into the beach because they were scared for me to drown. So I always sneak out of the house, come to the beach to ride the waves, and I get addicted to it, so I'm always here every day.
He tells me back then there weren't many Nigerians surfing or even swimming. Pekipuma tells me many Nigerians in Lagos don't know how.
I would say like 70% of Nigerians here in Lagos don't know how to swim, you know. And they have, like, water surrounding them, but they don't know how to make use of that water, you know.
The water is something that kids here are taught to be afraid of. Even now, Pekipuma says when he goes to surf outside of Lagos, Nigerians look at him like he's crazy.
They were like, they thought maybe I'm going to die, you know, when I was going in there. They were even scared of me, but they don't know that I'm really going out there to have fun.
to enjoy nature. So I was just cruising, catching waves upon waves, but I was just surfing alone, so it wasn't that enjoyable. It was, surfing is all about, like, you share the waves with your friends.
Surfing with friends is what it's all about for Pakipuma. In 2016, he started a surfing school here at Tarkwa Bay Beach. He tells me a lot of his clientele are tourists and foreigners or affluent Nigerians coming back from abroad. But he also teaches kids in the community here how to surf for free.
It takes you away from trouble, you know, because some of the kids, some of them sitting at home smoking, taking drugs or playing gambles or fighting, you know. So after that, just grab a board and just jump into the water and just spend your time there surfing, catching waves, you know, shredding waves upon waves. Too. So it makes you stay away from trouble.
Pakipuma tells me he has taught dozens of kids here how to surf. Now, many of them are teenagers who have gotten really good.
It's really amazing because the surfing community is growing so fast, you know. Like the kids, they used to surf every day after school, so they're getting good and good and good.
He says they're gearing up for a national surfing competition in mid-April. Pakipuma is hoping the best surfers will go on to represent Nigeria at international events, and maybe the Olympics one day. But up-and-coming surfers need resources to do that, he says.
Sponsorship. There's a lot of our kids here, they need to, like, get the equipment, you know. They need to get the shelters to, you know, for them to focus, where a lot of them sleeps at the beach here, which is not fair, you know, but if they can provide all these needs for them, trust me, these kids are very good. They're very, very good.
He says Nigeria's government needs to invest more in water sports and tourism. Speaking about that water, as we talk, I notice Pakipuma's eyes keep wandering to the beach. The tide is starting to rise, the perfect time to surf.
Well, now the tide is coming in now. You can see it's not as shallow as when you came in, so there's more water coming in.
So what's good about training at this beach?
This beach, you love it when it's, because it's easy to surf, the sense of you just have to know your positioning, you know, and just like be at the right spot. It's very easy to surf.
It's a good place for beginners.
It's a perfect place for beginners. Yeah, you're going to love it, trust me.
With that, we get into the water. Some young men who Pakipuma has coached are already out on their boards, paddling towards the sun. Surfing is definitely not an easy sport, but I can vouch that Godpiece Tamarakuro Pakipuma is a very good surf instructor. After a few tries, I was even able to stand up on the board, for a few seconds at least. For the world, I'm Halima Gakandi, Lagos, Nigeria.
You're listening to The World. Step inside the office of the software company PicArts, and it feels like pretty much any other tech startup.
It's kind of like a tech office in Los Angeles. We have the ping pong going.
But this is in Armenia, and the office is staffed by a lot of tech workers fleeing Russia. Plus, we hear what happens when you add 18 more strings to a guitar. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins this week. The fast that begins before sunrise and ends at sundown can last anywhere from 12 to 18 hours. Breaking the fast brings a unique focus back on food, especially when family and friends come together. This year, though, in some majority Muslim countries, those meals will be less plentiful. Hunger is on the rise in nations around the globe, including Afghanistan, Somalia, and Syria. To help us understand why, we reached out to David Beasley. He heads the UN World Food Program and joins us from Washington. David, what are the main drivers of global food instability at the moment, especially in the countries I mentioned?
Unfortunately, when you think of how much success has occurred in the last 200 years of reducing poverty, we're now going backwards. It is driven primarily by man-made conflict, climate shocks, COVID, economic disruption, and it's been devastating on the poor, so the poor countries. And in these Muslim countries, Ramadan, where they're fasting at this voluntary participation of, what, almost 2 billion people on the planet. But imagine, after, you know, 12, 14, whatever it may be, hours of fasting, many of the Muslims in these countries now have an involuntary fast because they can't get access to food.
There's a new report out, came out just this week, that says an estimated 43,000 people died in Somalia's unprecedented drought last year. I mean, that is a really alarming number. You were on the ground in Somalia last year, David. How do the factors you just kind of enumerated, how do they play out there?
You can't believe it's been literally five back-to-back rainy seasons didn't happen. And compound that with extremism of like Al-Shabaab and these types of organizations, the people in Somalia have just been devastated. We had famine knocking on the door, and thankfully, our friends in the United States, Democrats and Republicans, came together to fund extraordinary amounts of support inside Somalia that I don't want to say we averted it totally, but we've definitely postponed it for quite some time.
I mean, I was going to ask you, how do you keep a situation like Somalia from becoming a perennial reality? But as you said, 5 years in a row of no rain, it does seem like it is perennial. Is there a way to turn that around? How do you think about that?
Yeah, there is. There is a way to turn it around, even if it's perennial. And this is one of the things that I've been arguing with leaders around the world. Don't just give us money or food just to hand out to people. That is not a long-term solution. We've got programs and the capacity to rehabilitate the land, to green it up. So even in the harshest conditions where people can grow their own food. And let me just give you an example in the Sahel from like Mauritania, Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, that area where our beneficiaries are rehabilitating the land with water canals and water systems so they're growing on their own food. So this past year when the food crisis hit, we literally had 500,000 people that did not need food aid. And people then taking care of themselves, even in the drought conditions. When a Somalia does hit, if we've been able to have the flexibility to do resilient sustainability programs versus just handing out food, well, when a shock does hit, the cost is much less than it is when we just come in as hand out food, because you'll be doing that forever and ever. And like you say, Marco, what we're facing, like in Somalia, five rainy seasons back to back. So the climate is shifting. And while the world talks about mitigation, and I get it, they do. But we also have to be very serious about adaptation, because people have to survive in the meantime. And if you don't address adaptation, you will see starvation and mass migration and destabilization.
I'm speaking with David Beasley, the head of the UN World Food Program. In addition to those environmental pressures, Somalia and the Sahel, and you might as well add Afghanistan and Syria to the list, they face the threat of terrorists and extremist groups. And I'm just wondering, with so many different forces pushing up global food prices, where does that leave the most fragile countries? What are their options?
Well, the options can be very, very difficult. And this is where the major developed nations in the world have got to understand that they got to step up, because you'll pay for it one way or the other. And what we're facing now, for example, in the United States on the southern border, the number of people now talking about migrating from Central South America is five times what it was just a year and a half ago. Why? Because of food costs, inflation, devaluation of the currency, and compound that with other factors, then you begin to see why there is truly chaos, hell on earth, coming to a theater near you soon if we don't get on top of this stuff.
So on Saturday, Russia agreed to extend an agreement to allow grain shipments to leave Ukraine. Will that do much to address global hunger and limit price increases?
This is a country that grows enough food to feed 400 million people. You compound that with the conflicts, the climate shocks, and the COVID. We couldn't afford to lose that amount of food and to disrupt the supply chain system around the world. And we've got to get a longer version. The 60 days, look, it'll take what you can get, obviously, but at the same time, it needs to be 1 to 2 year extension. But the better thing is in that damn war. That's what needs to happen. Look, I don't care if you love, hate Russia. Regardless, we got to get fertilizers moving. We got to get food moving, because the entire world, 8 billion people, need fertilizers and they need food. Because what we're facing is because of fertilizer, lack of availability or the cost. For example, in Africa alone, where you got the entire African population, 70% of the people there depend upon smallholder farmers. And these smallholder farmers can't afford the fertilizer if they can get it at all. So you're going to have a dynamic impact compounded with the inflationary food costs and that devaluation of the currency, the national debt that occurred in many of these African countries who can't afford social safety net programs anymore. All these things are bubbling out there, and it should scare the mess out of you. And so our leaders in the world have got to solve some of these problems now before it's too late.
David, you've witnessed a lot of change in the world food supply in the past 6 years since you became head of the WFP. You're stepping down in April. What are a few of the top takeaways from your time at the top?
Well, somebody might say, well, why should I send my money to help the poor in Guatemala or Chad when we've got problems here? Well, if they end up migrating, it costs you 1,000 times more. If you're not going to do it out of the goodness of your heart, you better do it out of your national security interests and your financial interests, because it's a lot cheaper to help people where they are. People don't want to leave home, but if they don't have food, they'll do what they have to do.
David Beasley, when you sit down for breakfast or for dinner at the table to eat, after having seen up close and personal the many different types of hunger around the globe, what occurs to you as you think about the disparity between people who have enough food, like you and me, and those who face deprivation on a regular basis?
Well, you know what really, really burns you up? When you think about the fact there's $400 trillion of wealth out there on planet Earth and the billionaires, and I want people to make money, and that's great, nothing wrong with that, but my God, you have a moral obligation to help the poorest of the poor. And when these billionaires are making so much money out there and not reaching out to the poor, well, shame on us. It's avoidable. There's enough money to help the poorest of the poor.
David Beasley heads the UN World Food Program. He'll be stepping down from that role next month. Cindy McCain, who currently serves as U.S. ambassador to three UN food and agriculture agencies, will be the new World Food Program chief. David Beasley, very good to speak with you again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Since the invasion of Ukraine, hundreds of thousands of Russians have left their country. Many are workers in the tech sector. Some feared being drafted. For others, sanctions on banking meant they could no longer get paid. Those techies, though, didn't have to travel far to stay employed. Designers and programmers have easily found jobs in neighboring Armenia. As Levi Bridges reports from the capital, Yerevan, Russian talent is breathing life into Armenia's now booming tech industry.
After Russia invaded Ukraine last winter, Alexei Rostotsky went to an anti-war protest in Moscow. Denouncing the war is a crime in Russia, he took precautions.
Because there are a lot of cameras within the underground, and this would be like very available for Russian government. So I went there by foot.
Once Rostotsky arrived at the protest, he was quickly detained. He spent the night at a police station and was charged with participating in an unlawful protest. After he got out, he fled to Armenia.
If I had a tiny piece of belief that something can be changed in Russia, I would have stayed.
Rostotsky worked as a data analyst in Russia. It's the kind of job you can do remotely. So it was relatively easy for Rostotsky and thousands of other Russian tech workers to leave the country.
One of the best paying jobs in Russia is the IT jobs. So most of the people that came to Armenia were having tech jobs.
All these young professionals with high salaries are driving up rents in Yerevan, making housing unaffordable for locals. But they're helping to bolster Armenia's tech scene. Narek Aslikyan is the CEO of the Armenian Coding Academy in Yerevan. He says part of the secret sauce to Armenia's success as an emerging tech hub comes from Armenian immigrants in other parts of the world.
We have tight connections with California, we have tight connections with France, Germany, Sweden, and the only thing that connects these countries is the Armenian diaspora.
Aslikyan says members of the Armenian diaspora abroad are launching companies here with the support of venture capital from places like California that have large Armenian communities. Now, Russians are rapidly expanding tech's footprint here even more. Aslikyan says the number of tech workers in Armenia has more than doubled since the war started.
The number of talent, the number of companies opening branches in Armenia, the number of startups are growing rapidly.
He says the Russian influx is forcing the tech industry in Armenia to become more global. Many young Armenians don't speak Russian, so now these two groups of workers will have to find a common language, English.
So that's why it's an opportunity for both Armenian companies and also for the Russian companies relocating here to insist to their employees to learn English.
Since the war started, Russians have registered thousands of new businesses here, most of them in the tech field. The economy is now growing three times as fast as it was a year ago, according to Vahan Karapyan, Armenia's Minister of Economy. He says increased trade with Russia is helping to fuel the growth.
Many international companies left Russia, and Armenian-produced goods are now having less competition in Russia, and our export to Russia is also skyrocketing.
Inside a boxy office building in Yerevan, I visit PixArt, an Armenian tech company that produces a popular photo editing software. In the cafeteria, a couple workers are playing ping pong. There are comfy seats, lots of free drinks and snacks. Madeline Minyasin, who works in employee development at PixArt, shows me around.
Kind of like a tech office in Los Angeles. We have the ping pong going.
I was just about to say, it looks like every tech office I've been in San Francisco.
It's an exciting time in Armenian tech offices like these. The arrival of so many Russian tech workers has cemented this industry as a key part of Armenia's future.
Having so many new Russian colleagues on the ground has expanded the creativity, the mindset, the solutions. There's just a more diverse opportunity at the table.
Russians living here do worry there may be repercussions from Moscow down the road. Worried about a serious brain drain, some Russian lawmakers want to seize the property of those who left the country in an effort to coerce them to return home. But with the war raging in Ukraine, few young Russians here plan to return anytime soon. They're helping make Armenia a global player in the tech industry. And for the moment, that's good not only for the Russians here, but also for Armenia. For The World, Levi Bridges, Yerevan, Armenia.
The globe is already heating dangerously and is likely to pass a key climate threshold by the beginning of the 2030s. Preventing the worst impacts of climate change is still possible, though, with solutions already available. That is something yesterday's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report stressed. For more on those solutions, we turn to a lead IPCC author, Elizabeth Gilmore. She's also an associate professor of climate change, technology, and policy at Carleton University in Ottawa, in Canada.
These reports outline a wide range of feasible and effective solutions for adaptation and mitigation that are available now towards 2030. We also assess that the major barriers to this include a lack of sense of urgency and the need for increased political commitment.
Specifically, though, on technologies, I mean, what is out there right now that you think is not being used enough that could make a difference?
I mean, we already see that renewable energy is generally less expensive than fossil fuels. We also see that when communities act together, they can be redesigned to better survive natural hazards. So, for example, we highlight the effectiveness of early warning systems. In some places, we can build homes that are less susceptible to burning. We have a very deep toolkit at this point.
Is there a combination of interventions that you think could actually play a role?
So land use, the design of new infrastructure, can be based with the appropriate forward-looking climate information. We can change how insurance is priced to help people recognize the hazards that they face right now. We can think about how to transform our coasts. Our coasts are at great risk. But for example, if we start only by putting in place levees, we will find that over time that we will be reaching limits. Communities that take more deliberate and anticipatory action will be able to not just survive, but thrive.
If the toolkit is so deep, why is it not being used more?
I mean, in part, it is that no group alone can enact all these changes. Everyone must be involved. We need to include governments that can mandate and incentivize changes, businesses that often control many of the decisions about greenhouse gas emissions. We need to really enable citizens who can turn up the pressure on both.
I got to say, I hear all that, but, you know, I look at my daughter and I really wonder what kind of world she's going to be inheriting.
I also have a 4-year-old daughter. And like any parent, I worry deeply about what her future will look like. What gives me hope is, in fact, our shared sense of cooperation and the potential for transformative solidarity on this point. These changes need to be everywhere. They need to be for everybody. They need to be everything, and they need to be all at once.
Elizabeth Gilmore is an author with the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and an associate professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Elizabeth, thank you very much for your time today.
And thank you.
For many people in Ukraine, living through a war means figuring out how to stay safe. For one family of Ukrainian artists, scattered from Kyiv to a small village in Massachusetts, they're also trying to figure out the meaning of what they're creating right now. The answer, it turns out, is different for each of them. The World's Carol Hills reports.
The Isupov family is spread across Ukraine and the United States. Sergei Isupov lives in western Massachusetts. He's 59 and makes his living as a ceramic artist.
I combine sculpture and painting together.
Sergei's ceramic sculptures are surreal. Humans, animals, sometimes a combination of both, with paintings of other figures, often incongruous, onto them. Essentially, he mixes 2D with 3D. Sergei's been in the U.S. for more than 30 years. He says his life here has brought him incredible artistic freedom and an established, reliable world of galleries, dealers, and museums for his work. But there's one downside to all that stability.
I want to say for creativity, conflict definitely helps. We even have this idiom, if you're not sick, nothing to write about.
Well, now he has plenty to be sick about. The war back home in Ukraine has been shattering. His mother Nelly and brother Ilya live in Kyiv, and he talks to them all the time.
Sometimes I talk to my mom, I hear sirens in the back. So already for a year, I feel what I do if something happens, how I react. I go and help, and I never come out with this clear answer.
Sergei's father, Vladimir, was a well-known painter in Ukraine. In recent years, he lived on the 20th floor of a high-rise in Bucha, outside of Kyiv. Shortly after the war started, the elevator stopped working, and he didn't leave his building for 3 months. After the Russian bombing and massacre there last year, he stopped making art, stopped taking calls from his family, and withdrew. He died last month. Sergei never had a chance to say goodbye. His parents, Nelly and Vladimir, met in art school in Odessa in the late 1950s. This was the Soviet period. Afterward, they settled in Kyiv and raised their two sons, Sergei and Ilya, and basically insisted that they become artists too. Nelly is 84 and still lives in Kyiv. Like Sergei, she's a ceramic artist, but her work is less surreal. Her ceramic sculptures celebrate the wonder of the world. She makes lots of animals, birds, nature, even teapots with creatures on the handle.
Алло, привет.
Да-да-да-да, Сережа.
Да, привет.
Сергей calls her on Messenger to check in. Nelly is full of energy. Through Sergei, I ask her why it's important to keep making art during a time of war. Her answer surprises me.
Хорошо, сейчас расскажу.
Nelly says it's really important to be creative. She says she's more active as an artist now than she was before the war. She feels like it's her obligation to bring art to the public, that it's a form of peace. In August, Nelly had an exhibit at the Kyiv Art Gallery at the National Museum. A week after it ended, a bomb exploded nearby, causing some damage to the museum. Nelly's response? Basically a shrug. Despite Sergei begging her to come stay with him in Massachusetts, she's not leaving. Nelly says she feels like she's not in the war, but more like an observer. She says she likes being in the middle of the action. Sergei says his mother's ceramic sculptures have always been bright and colorful, but since the war started last year, even more so. If Sergei's mother sounds optimistic and energetic about Ukraine, his younger brother Ilya sounds exhausted and discouraged. He has 4 children, and they've all been dispersed.
I'm in Kyiv, all my kids around the world, like Europe. I mean, I did visit them a couple of times. They came over and, I mean, the half of the country is like, well, most of the country is like that. The family not together and things are completely no jobs.
Ilya is 52 and, like his late father, a painter. Unlike his mother, Ilya would like to leave Ukraine but can't. Because of the war, Ukrainian men under 65 are required to stay. I ask him if the war has affected his art.
For sure. I mean, of course, like, you cannot avoid it.
Ilya says that unlike his mother, he feels like he's living in a bad movie, and he can't imagine painting flowers. But one thing Ilya has painted since the start of the war is very personal. It's a painting that shows a small blue car driving through a war zone. You can't quite see who's driving, but you can see their hands on the steering wheel. Two terrified teenagers look out the window as warplanes fly overhead through smoke and debris from nearby bomb attacks. A teddy bear is on the road just ahead, about to be run over. There are several colorful My Little Pony dolls on the roof of the car. Somehow, and perhaps symbolically, they're not falling off or flying away. Turns out that drive through hell really happened. That's actually Ilya at the wheel, and the two girls in the car are his teenage daughters. Shortly after that drive, Ilya moved them out of Ukraine.
This is...
Back in Massachusetts, Sergei is polishing some imperfections on a figurative sculpture that he recently fired in the kiln. He says he's noticed a change in his artwork. Some of his ceramic figures are starting to fight, like in a boxing match.
And maybe this is how I right now see how this connects with my work, because I'm right now like an observer. I'm not there, but I talk to my parents, to my brother, and all this information would flow, but I'm sometimes surprised.
Another surprise is that he's been thinking a lot more about the past, about the home and the country and the family he left behind. Sergei left Ukraine decades ago and didn't really look back. But now he thinks about it all the time. He now has that little bit of sickness that he says an artist needs to go deep. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
We close today with new music by an artist from India. Debashish Bhattacharya is a pandit, a master of the Hindustani slide guitar. When he first began playing the classical Indian repertoire on a basic six-string classical guitar, purists in India balked. But Bhattacharya stuck with it and created a whole new piece of hardware to perform those classical works. In 1978, he invented the chaturungi. Bhattacharya took the six-string design recognizable to anyone in the West and added lots of strings to it, up to 18 more on the guitar neck. This gave the chaturungi that sitar vibe. The word slide may imply something adjacent to the blues or country western. Bhattacharya's new album, The Sound of the Soul, reminds us that those microtones, those uncommon notes in the Western chromatic scale that sit between sharps and flats, they are universally embraced and at home in many cultures. That is our show on this Tuesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online all the time at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. I hope to see you again tomorrow.